KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
I actually think the psychedelic experience is significant because it addresses the two biggest problems we face as a civilization, which I would list as tribalism and the environmental crisis. They both involve the objectifying of the other, whether that other is nature or other people. And what is tribalism but a collective version of ego? So here we have a tool that, at least for the individual, breaks down these ego formations, allows us to have a deep connection with the natural world and focus on our likeness rather than our unlikeness with other people. But how do you prescribe a drug to a whole culture?
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. In this series, The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we celebrate social and scientific innovators with breakthrough solutions for restoring people and planet, creating a future environment of hope.
Support for The Bioneers' Revolution from the Heart of Nature is provided in part by Organic Valley Family of Farms and by the generous support of listeners like you.
LSD does cause psychosis in the people who don't take it. So said Timothy Leary at the height of the 60s after LSD escaped from medical labs and went wild in the streets. It was as though the thriving counterculture had moved from Kansas to Oz. Meanwhile, a plethora of medical experiments was showing real therapeutic merit. LSD demonstrated so much promise in treating alcoholism that Alcoholics Anonymous founder Bill Wilson seriously considered including it in his program. In 1966, LSD was criminalized, summarily stigmatizing and halting medical research for decades to come. Until, that is, the past decade plus, when a quiet renaissance of serious medical research has once again arisen to study LSD and other psychedelics such as psilocybin mushrooms. At the same time, the popular usage of psychedelics in the U.S. has swelled to become as big as in the heyday of the 60s. As if to punctuate the threshold moment with an exclamation point, in 2018, a new book hit the bestseller lists. In How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence, the acclaimed journalist Michael Pollan documents how psychedelics are helping people with everything from overcoming addiction and depression to easing the existential terror of terminal illness. He calls it white coat shamanism. But that's just one piece of a much more curious picture. Pollan slips through the rabbit hole into the mystery of consciousness itself. Could the transformational healing that psychedelics can bring on the personal ego level translate into cultural healing that could address the greatest issues of our time? This is The Reluctant Psychonaut, How Psychedelics Changed Michael Pollan's Mind. I'm Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
I was a very reluctant psychonaut. I had very little experience. I kind of got into it when I was about to turn 60. which is, I know, not age appropriate. And the reasons for that were that I was afraid. I was a little late to the 60s party, and by the time it kind of swam into my awareness, all you heard were terrifying stories about people jumping out of windows and staring at the sun till they went blind and scrambled your chromosomes, and all that kept me away. I also thought I was psychologically too fragile, I think, that this assault on my psyche I might not be able to withstand. So I kind of, with the exception of a couple low-dose psilocybin experiments in my late 20s, I really had nothing to do with it. So I bring not a long history, but the power of first sight to this subject.
Writer Michael Pollan's gift of first sight has consistently shifted the national conversation on issues central to human existence, from our relationship to food with his book The Omnivore's Dilemma to our relationship with plants in The Botany of Desire. With How to Change Your Mind, the rigorous reporter and congenital skeptic has provided an authoritative analysis of everything science has learned about psychedelics and the mysteries yet to be plumbed. But what made him letter perfect for this mission improbable is his brand, immersive journalism. In other words, he samples his subject. At a Bioneers conference, Michael Pollan shared a travelogue of his repertorial and personal journey with psychedelics.
I got into psychedelics as a journalist. It was a journalistic quest that gradually evolved, actually very quickly evolved, into a spiritual quest, into a personal quest. I'd read about these studies of terminal cancer patients being given psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to help them with their existential terror. Now, to me, when I first heard about it, this seemed like a really bad idea. The last thing I would want if I was facing right up against my mortality was to lose my mind. This is not underground work. This was going on at NYU and at Johns Hopkins, two of the leading medical institutions in the country. So I got an assignment to write about it for The New Yorker, and it resulted in a piece called The Trip Treatment, which you can read online. And I started interviewing these cancer patients. The background to this story, which I didn't realize till much later, was that my father had a terminal cancer diagnosis around the same time. He just died in January. He was in his late 80s, and he never wanted to talk about how was he thinking about death? How was he processing this cataclysm? Either he was processing it internally or he was in denial. I never sort of figured it out. So I had this intense curiosity to engage in these conversations with people who were confronting their mortality and were trying to deal with it. And they were the most amazing people and the most amazing conversations. People would have experiences in which they went into their body and confronted their cancer, in which they met God. These are high-dose experiences in which they felt their sense of self completely dissolve and followed by emerging into some larger entity. Some of them, I remember, beheld this great plane of consciousness that they understood their own consciousness would join when their bodies died. And they emerged from these experiences, about two-thirds of them, all the ones who had powerful mystical experiences, with a completely new understanding of where they were and what was happening to them. Many of them lost their fear of dying. It was the most incredible thing and very hard for me to understand from outside. I remember talking, there was one woman I interviewed who had ovarian cancer. It was in remission, but she still had this terror of recurrence. This is a woman in her early 60s and a fairly timid woman, figure skating instructor in Manhattan. And she went into her body on her experience and she saw this black mass underneath her rib cage. And she realized that wasn't her cancer because it was in the wrong place. It was her fear. Now, when you do one of these guided experiences, there are two people with you, a man and a woman the whole time. You're wearing eye shades and listening to music, a playlist on headphones. And all of a sudden, she screams at the black mass, although they don't know this, "Get the f*** out of my body!" And with that, her fear just poof, disappeared. And I wrote in the article, in the draft, that, and her fear was, substantially diminished, something safe that would get past the New Yorker fact checkers. But when they called her to read this, and they said, is it true that your fear was substantially diminished, fear of death? She said, no, he got that wrong. That's completely wrong. My fear was eliminated.
Leading medical researcher Stanislav Grof, who worked extensively with LSD while it was legal in the 50s and 60s at the U.S. National Institute of Mental Health, observed one major therapeutic discovery of that era. When you change consciousness, Grof said, it activates the psyche's self-healing potential. The fact that we have such narrow and superficial psychiatry means that we diagnose as psychotic certain states which could potentially be transformative, healing, and even evolutionary. The current explosion of medical studies to determine the therapeutic value of psychedelic substances is once again revealing the self-healing potential of the psyche, from veterans suffering from PTSD to people struggling with autism, depression, and addiction. The studies span the globe from the U.S. to Israel, Switzerland, Brazil, and the Netherlands. As Michael Pollan absorbed the depth of the transformative experiences of cancer patients, he knew he had to take his own trip into immersive journalism.
But I have to say, I was terrified. I had several guided and unguided experiences on several different medicines. And every night, there would be this ping-pong match of, are you crazy? You could have a heart attack. You're going to go to the middle of nowhere with this guy, and is he going to call 911 if something happens? And then this other voice was like, aren't you really curious to know what would happen? And I realized the first voice was my ego defending itself, because it knew what was coming, an assault on it. And the problem with your ego is it has command of your rational faculties, so it makes really good arguments that are hard to ignore. But in every case, I was able to ignore it. But you have to realize, too, when you start late, like, yeah, like I had to call my cardiologist before I did this. You know, when you're 60, it's... So he was cool with everything except MDMA. And he may have been wrong about that. I don't know.
In his book, The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World, Michael Pollan explored the provocative question of whether plants have consciousness, intentions, and purpose. But this proposition had remained an intellectual abstraction for the avid gardener, until, that is, he took a deep dive into psychedelics in his beloved garden.
Without a guide, I had a fairly high-dose experience in my garden, and I had a very strong sense that consciousness was spread more equally over the natural world than I had ever thought before, and that as I was gazing at these leaves were gazing back at me with incredible benign affect, but that everything was much more alive than it had ever been. And so what had been this intellectual conceit became this felt truth, this conviction. And I think that's one of the things psychedelics do, is that they put flesh on ideas that I already had. So I want to read you a brief passage from what it was like to walk through my garden toward the end of this experience. Picture a summer day in New England, very hot summer day with lots of things flitting around. My walk back to the house was, I think, the peak of the experience and comes back to me now in the colors and tones of a dream. There was again the sense of pushing my body through a mass of air that had been sweetened by phlox and was teeming, almost frenetic with activity. The dragonflies, big as birds, were now out in force, touching down just long enough to kiss the phlox blossoms and then lift off before madly crisscrossing the garden path. There were more dragonflies than I had ever seen in one place, so many, in fact, that I wasn't completely sure if they were real. Judith, my wife, later confirmed the sighting when I got her to come outside. And as they executed their flight patterns, they left behind them contrails that persisted in the air, or so at least it appeared. Dusk now approaching, the air traffic in the garden had built to a riotous crescendo. The pollinators making their last rounds of the day, the plants still signifying to them with their flowers, me, me, me. In one way, I knew this scene well, the garden coming briefly to life after the heat of a summer day had relented, but never had I felt so integral to it. I was no longer the alienated human observer, gazing at the garden from a distance, whether literal or figural, but rather felt part and parcel of all that was transpiring here. So the flowers were addressing me as much as the pollinators, and perhaps because the very air that afternoon was such a felt presence, it was so humid, one's usual sense of oneself as a subject observing objects in space, objects that have been thrown into relief and rendered discreet by the apparent void that surrounds them, gave way to a sense of being deep inside and fully implicated in the scene. One more being in relation to the myriad other beings and to the whole. Everything is interaction and reciprocal, wrote Alexander von Humboldt, the great 18th century naturalist. And that felt very much the case. And so for the first time did this that he also said, I myself am identical with nature.
When we return, how psychedelics challenge the committed scientific materialist Michael Pollan's view of spirituality, and how psychedelics may present valuable tools for society at large to address our greatest crises. This is The Reluctant Psychonaut, How Psychedelics Changed Michael Pollan's Mind. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. To see and hear more from Michael Pollan and other Bioneers, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit bioneers.org. Many researchers believe the positive results that study subjects experience in medical trials have as much to do with their skillful guides as with the substances. In fact, controlled conditions can be crucial for what is often an uncontrollable, disorienting, and alternately terrifying or ecstatic experience. When Michael Pollan decided to take a high dose of psilocybin mushrooms, he knew a sense of security was crucial. He met with his guide, Mary, and felt safe with her. As he put on his eye shades and settled into the couch, sure enough, the trip got off to a rocky start.
One of the things that happens on psychedelics is you can see music. And what I saw was a computer-generated black and white landscape that was not my thing. I don't like video games. It's not the space I wanted to be in. I wanted natural imagery. And it went on and on and on, and I started to feel kind of claustrophobic. And we argued about the music, and I had her change it, but I was stuck in computer world. And finally, I had to pee, and I took off the eye shades. And what the amazing thing is, you can kind of like come back into reality when you need to for a little while. And she kind of helped me get to the bathroom, and I was very careful not to look in the mirror. You don't want to do that. I said this to an audience in England of very experienced people, and they were like, oh yes, trip face. So I didn't do that. And I produced this spectacular crop of diamonds, and then made my way back to the futon where I was. And Mary asked me if I wanted a booster dose. And I was in for the whole thing, so I said yes. And then this really weird thing happens, and she's kneeling by my side. I'm in this futon, and I look at her, and she's normally Scandinavian looking with long blonde hair and high cheekbones, and she suddenly had black hair and weathered brown skin. And I knew exactly who she had turned into, Maria Sabina, who some of you will know is the Mazatec woman from Huautla de Jimenez in Mexico, who actually gave the first white man from the West psilocybin in the 1950s. So a key figure in the history of psychedelics. And she had turned, and I didn't think I should tell Mary what had happened to her. So I took the additional dose and I put on the eye shades again, and then the most spooky thing happened. I'm out of computer world now, and I suddenly, And the pronouns are going to sound weird, I see myself burst into just this cloud of little post-it notes. I'd been blasted to bits. But I was watching the scene. There was another perspective that had opened up, and I watched, and then I looked out. I'd been liquefied. I had turned into paint or butter, just kind of coating the landscape. But I was fine with it. This other I had emerged, was like, that's what happens, you turn into paint. And it was the most amazing thing. I didn't have a self, but this other perspective had arisen that had this perfect equanimity. Whatever happened is fine. It wasn't exactly me, and I don't know what it was. Aldous Huxley would say it was the mind at large. It was some kind of universal consciousness. But I realized it was precisely the consciousness that those cancer patients had described to me. The one that made the death of their bodily selves and their egos bearable. And when that happens, when your self falls apart, if you feel safe, because if you fight this, that's a bad trip. If you feel safe without the walls of the ego and the self, these channels open up. What rushes in is your sense of connection. You have no defenses anymore. You are wide open, and so you merge, whether it's with nature or other people, and you feel these channels of love opening up, and this sense of fellow feeling with natural things. And for me, there was a moment where I merged with a piece of music that I had persuaded her to put on, this Bach unaccompanied cello concerto, which is an amazing, sad piece. I mean, it's all about death. This is the suite in G minor. And I just became the music, I became the cello, I felt the bow, the friction of the bow going over my skin. It was just this perfect merging.
In truth, Pollan's sense of ego death, of merging with the oneness of all creation, echoes the same vision that shamans and indigenous peoples who use psychedelic substances have described for centuries and millennia. Today's white coat shamanism stands in this shamanic lineage that says it's all connected, and we're all connected. As Pollan wrote, when the ego dissolves, so does a bounded conception not only of ourself, but of our self-interest. What emerges in its place is invariably a broader, more open-hearted, and altruistic, that is, more spiritual, idea of what matters in life. One in which a new sense of connection, or love, however defined, seems to figure prominently. So what happens the morning after?
In one of these guided trips, you come back the next day for an integration session. And I came back, and she asked me what had happened. I told her I'd had this ego dissolution. And she's like, well, that's worth the price of admission, don't you think? And I said, yeah, but it's over. I'm back. My ego's back. It's in uniform. It's on patrol. My defenses are all back. And she said, well, you've had a taste of another way to be, of a more open, less defended way to be. And you have that memory, and you can reconnect to it. And I asked her how, and she said, through meditation. And that is now how I reconnect to it. I mean, I think it's a very logical outgrowth, because you can't do psychedelics every day. It's a really bad idea. I don't recommend it. But you can have that opening that can help you. Now, I want to say something about the larger value of this experience, because I think that it has a relevance to our situation, our social, political, and environmental situation. I actually think the psychedelic experience is significant because it addresses the two biggest problems we face as a civilization, which I would list as tribalism and the environmental crisis. They're actually very similar. They both involve the objectifying of the other, whether that other is nature or other people, people of different faiths, different races, different political views. And what is tribalism but a collective version of ego, right? It's defensive, it builds walls, it refuses connection. So here we have a tool that, at least for the individual, breaks down these ego formations, allows us to have a deep connection with the natural world and focus on our likeness rather than our unlikeness with other people. That seems enormously promising. But how do you prescribe a drug to a whole culture? So that's the challenge that faces us. We have a tool that addresses the two biggest problems we face, and it certainly works well in the individual, and perhaps if more individuals could have this experience, but that is a challenge. How do you democratize this loss of ego, right? Temporary loss of ego for learning purposes. And here's where my understanding of spirituality changed, and I'll leave you with this. Remember I said the opposite of spiritual, I always believed, was material, and that those two things could not be reconciled. I no longer think that's the case. Everything I experienced can be understood without any resort to the supernatural, okay? Connection to other people, connection to nature. Scientists tell us we are. We're social beings. We're totally dependent on one another, and we're completely part and parcel of the natural world. We're no different than any other species. It's just our egos, intent on objectifying things, won't let us see this. So really, I came to understand, I had it all wrong about spiritual experience. The opposite of spiritual is egotistical. And to the extent we can work on that, and we need to work on that to have any spiritual development. So I'll leave you with that thought. How do we take that knowledge and democratize it, give it to as many people as possible, and use it to untie this giant knot? So, thank you very much. Thank you.
The Reluctant Psychonaut: How Psychedelics Changed Michael Pollan's Mind. You can see and hear more from Michael Pollan and explore award-winning Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, blogs, and videos online at bioneers.org. For information on attending the National Bioneers Conference and Bioneers events in your area, please visit bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. The Bioneers Revolution from the Heart of Nature is a production of Bioneers and Collective Heritage Institute. Executive producer, Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Our theme music is co-written by the Baka Forest people of Cameroon and Baka Beyond from the album East to West. All royalties from Baka compositions and performances go to the Baka Forest people through the charity Global Music Exchange. Find out more at globalmusicexchange.org. Additional music was made available by Rod Hamilton, Tiffany Seal, and Daniel Birch at freemusicarchive.org. The opinions expressed in the Bioneers Revolution from the Heart of Nature are those of the presenters and are not necessarily those of Bioneers and Collective Heritage Institute, the underwriters, or this radio station. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 0118.
This program was made possible in part by Organic Valley's pasture-raised organic dairy products, bringing the good from our family farmers to your table at organicvalley.coop, and by the generous support of listeners like you.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
As he held open the door of the recreation hall, the fourth-year boy looked at me and smiled. Then he said, "I shouldn't worry about it. It could happen to anyone." It was kind of him, I suppose. I was in first year in boarding school, just 5 months in. It was a Sunday evening in February. There was snow outside. I hadn't seen home in 6 weeks, and I was a little bit sniffly. The reason I was sniffly was that I had a cold. I was one of 300 boys living in a big drafty building, and at that time of year, if you weren't outdoors getting pummeled in rugby training, you were likely to be indoors trying to keep warm. Catching a cold was no big deal. The fourth-year boy had thought I was crying. I wasn't crying, but a lot of boys were, including some of the big boys. Maybe particularly the big boys, furtively wiping their eyes as everyone filed out of the recreation hall and up to the dormitories to bed. The boarding school in Roscrea, run by the Cistercian Order, was a more Spartan place then than it would be now. It was a life of early mornings, daily mass, mandatory rugby, classes on Saturday. Respite came on Sunday evenings, after tea, when a big screen was unfurled in the recreation hall, the lights were switched off, and all 300 of us were treated to a movie, or, as it was known then, a film. The Sunday film took your mind off things. You'd stock up at the tuck shop with your Coke and crisps and chocolate and settle in with your pals in the standard-issue hard chairs for some 2 hours of John Wayne or Clint Eastwood or whoever. For the most part, they were films you'd expect boys to like. In that first year we had, for example, The Hornet's Nest, Support Your Local Gunfighter, and Jaws. But for one particular Sunday, the chilly polar Sunday that was 12th of February 1978, the Reverend Fathers decided that we would have something different. How about one of the weepiest romances of all time? How about Love Story? The plot of Love Story is simple enough. Rich kid, Harvard law student, falls in love with working class girl. His family disapproves, they get married, she falls gravely ill. In the film's opening sequence, the man sits alone on a bench in winter snow and tells us his wife has died. No spoiler alert here. From the very beginning, you know where it's going. As the male lead, Ryan O'Neill is charming, handsome, plays ice hockey. Opposite him, Ali McGraw is witty, assertive, musically talented. Strong characters, then. We're on their side. Throughout, though, there is the mournful musical accompaniment that signals the impending tragedy. What are 300 boys to do? It's as though nobody saw this coming. And you can't just get up and leave. You don't want to get up and leave. I remember hearing a sob and looking round me. It was one of the older boys. Then another sob. And another. All older boys. At 13, I was only barely out of childhood. At that age, in boarding school and far away from home, well, you could be forgiven for shedding a tear or two. But that didn't mean I was going to cry about a girl, about something I saw in a film. All I could identify with in Love Story was the snow, which right then was as prevalent in Roscrea as it was in Boston. But the older boys, well, what was it with them? In the half century or so since it was made, the box office phenomenon that was Love Story has been celebrated and ridiculed in roughly equal measure. On a more recent, more mature viewing, I found it entertaining but flawed. There are unlikely leaps in the plot, and you'd have to wonder about some of the lines, like the most famous one. Love means never having to say you're sorry. Really? Yet Love Story remains one of my most remembered films. I remember it because of the effect it had on the big boys at school. The sight of them, big lads crying into their crisps. The thing is, boys do cry. Even big boys cry. You might not want people to know, particularly when you're at school. Then you look around you and you see other boys crying too. As for me, though, whatever else I was doing on that Sunday evening long ago, I wasn't crying. I was only sniffling. You see, I had a cold.
I never thought about how the Irish crossed the road before I moved away. It's not the kind of thing you think about, and it's certainly not the kind of thing that you think has any national character. But then I moved to Amsterdam, a city where the people are an obedient, unfussy kind, the sort to not question a rule, to enjoy a good system, the sort to wait for a red man even on an empty road. When I first moved to the Dutch capital, a professor advised me that one of the great difficulties of settling into the city would be adjusting to its rhythms. I wondered when it was that he'd last tried to set up a bank account or secure health insurance with the Dutch. The rhythms of the city, spoken like a true academic. But I found myself recalling his words in the weeks that followed, usually when I was crossing the road. I was out of sync with the rule-observing Dutch. My impulse to anticipate a traffic sequence for myself earned me disapproving looks from fellow pedestrians and one too many close shaves with outraged cyclists. The Dutch have little time for notion-taking. They're a straight-talking people who make plans and stick to them. You offer them a cup of tea and they will answer truthfully and directly. They're not expecting you to cajole a yes out of them and get very irritated when you try to do this. I admired the seamlessness of their way of life when I first arrived. They're very efficient, I'd report home. Buses arrive as scheduled and oh, they hate nothing more than a queue. I was a parody of any Irish person to have ever moved there. I was sure that any displacement I felt could be quickly redressed by a cup of Barry's tea or a sneaky pint. I was surprised then by how reassured I was by the language of Dublin pedestrian life upon my return home. I found myself struck, maybe even charmed, by chancers waving down cars as if it was their God-given right to cross precisely where and when they wanted to, calculating traffic sequences as if it was some kind of puzzle waiting to be solved, as if the traffic lights weren't specifically there to do all of this work for them. In my wistful state of return, I found something poetic about the excessively long time the orange man bleeped on, a seeming acknowledgement of the specifically Irish understanding of this signal, which we take to mean speed up rather than slow down. In fact, how Dubliners cross the road seemed to capture all that I had actually missed while I was away, and it was nothing a cup of tea or a pint could ever have replicated. Only in coming home did I realise that what I had really missed in all that time was the feeling of getting away with it. Just the possibility of it made me giddy again. For all my efforts to achieve the cool coherence of the Dutch, I'd been yearning for the wiggle room of it all. Go on, go on. Whatever you say, say nothing. Rules are made to be bent here. It's why we lose our minds at an all-you-can-eat buffet, slipping croissants into our pockets as if an apocalypse might strike before lunch. I mean, it had been over a year since a stranger had winked or rolled their eyes at me. So these days, I soak up the swagger of those who have just bent the traffic sequence to their will, the smug satisfaction of someone already walking across the road as the green man lights up. Witnessing these jammy victories has been the ultimate restoration since moving back. I love now getting to blitz past tourists who have stopped oh so earnestly at an orange man. I relish the in-joke satisfaction of knowing exactly when you're good to chance it on Thomas Street, or in understanding that there is simply safety in numbers when crossing O'Connell Bridge. I love getting away with it again, recognising the eye-bulging, brow-raising Jesus look of it all. The rhythm of the place, I suppose.
The girl's a fool, she broke the rules, she heard a lie. This time he will break down. She's lost this trust and so she bust all this lost. The system has broke down. Robots has broke down.
There is something very special about Parisian light. On the day I met her, a late spring sun had just cleared the rooftops opposite Marianne Faithful's apartment. It shone a spotlight on both her and the chair on which she sat. Her endless cigarette smoke drifted upwards and made a halo above her head. It wreathed itself about her in a way that a cat might sit upon a person's shoulder and insinuate itself about their neck. As she spoke, she conducted her words with the hand that held the cigarette. I had arranged our Paris meeting so that I might find out more about one of our long-time friends, a companion from the days when Marianne Faithful was the toast of Soho and an icon of swinging London. The days when she was muse to the greats of rock music, a muse to Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. She was the original wild child of the 1960s, and sometimes wild children attract those of similar disposition. In 2012, at Christie's Auction Rooms, London, a hammer came down on a Francis Bacon painting. The sale fetched a record-breaking price for a piece of his art. The painting, titled A Portrait of Henrietta Mores, was sold for 25 million euros. The subject depicts a young nude woman lying on a bed and is rendered with brutally visceral brushstrokes, a style typical of the artist. Like Marianne, Henrietta Mores was also a beautiful, troubled and seductive child of the 60s London set. She lived a bohemian life in the company of artists, poets and emerging rock musicians. It was in this community she first encountered Marianne. In the aftermath of Marianne's breakup with Mick Jagger in 1970, she and Henrietta shared a small squat in St. John's Wood, London, and supported each other through times of mutual addiction to alcohol and drugs. In the late 1970s, Marianne released the album Broken English and embarked upon a tour of Ireland's ballrooms and smaller music venues. She was accompanied by Henrietta, who acted as her tour manager. Reading accounts of this tour from Henrietta's autobiography, it would not be an exaggeration to state that the subsequent concerts were both an artistic and financial fiasco. This was why I had come to visit Marianne. Following Henrietta's death, where better to learn about an artist's muse than from another artist's muse? Although we spoke at length about Marianne's relationship with her late friend, it was about our visit to Kilkenny Castle in 1967 that our conversation kept returning. I recalled how our local paper featured herself and Mick Jagger on the front cover for weeks. In one such image, Marianne is seen standing beside Mick. She wears a long woven cloak, holds a plate of food, and as ever, a cigarette in her hand. On her head is an elaborate straw hat decorated with what appears to be real roses. I tell her how her presence in Kilkenny unsettled us teenage boys. She and Mick brought excitement, anarchy and colour to what we believed was a dull existence. We tuned into pirate radio stations at night beneath the bedclothes, trying to catch music as it faded in and out. Sound waves in our ears that might be like the swelling seas on which those pirate ships sailed. We counted the hours and we counted the days. We cut posters from fan magazines and tacked them to our bedroom walls. Naturally, Marianne was in a place of prominence. We adopted hippie fashion by altering the ordinary contents of drab wardrobes, wore flowers behind our ears, and when Marianne and Mick returned to their rock and roll lifestyles, we returned to chalk dust and classroom ennui. On that afternoon in Paris, much to our delight, I explained the lasting impact she had on our 17-year-old Christian brother's educated lives. Before I bade farewell to her, Marianne offered me a Kilkenny anecdote. I suspect I might have heard it somewhere before, but for what it's worth, this is her story. Both herself and Mick were on a pub crawl during Kilkenny City's infamous beer festival. As they drifted between pubs, a pack of screaming girls appeared to be running after Mick. He ducked into a doorway, but was surprised that they passed him by unheeded, still screaming and still pursuing their quarry. When Marianne asked who they were chasing, a bystander told her that the girls thought they'd glimpsed Dickie Rock and wanted his autograph. At that time in Kilkenny, Dickie might have been more famous than Mick. However, Marianne was proud that her song, Dreaming My Dreams, remained number one in the Irish music charts for 7 successive weeks in 1976. Written for her by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, it was her only number one hit anywhere in the world. By the time I closed her front door, the sun was setting. Crossing the street, I looked back and saw a light had come on in her apartment. Through the open window, I believe I could hear her singing. And yes, there was a warm wind blowing through Paris, and it seemed to carry a trace of tobacco smoke on its breath.
the charity hop. When the girl with blue hair jingled the decrepit old piano to life in the charity shop, we lifted our faces from tired rummaging amongst the rails of deadbeat blouses. We might as well have been in Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, Nashville, as she plucked out the ragtime classic, Scott Joplin's Entertainer. We picked up the tune, two-stepped to her cheerful rhythms, swayed to her offbeat honky-tonk. The girl with blue hair flashed a smile of studs, bowed as we applauded her performance. Blew kisses from tattooed fingertips to the old man who raised his frayed cap and called her a great girl entirely.
The American Jesuit, Father Daniel A. Laud, a religious consultant to Cecil B. DeMille, was not enamoured by the arrival of talking films. Silent smut had been bad, he declared many years later in his autobiography, but vocal smut cried to the censors for vengeance. Father Laud helped establish the rules within films called the Hays Code of Behaviour in the 1930s. This ensured that, among other things, if an on-screen husband leaned over his wife who was in bed, the husband, like a professional snooker player, was required to keep one foot on the ground. When Ireland's first film censor was asked if he knew anything about film, he replied huffily, "No, but I know the Ten Commandments." His successor, a doctor, could at least claim one direct connection with Hollywood. When Audrey Hepburn once fell from a horse while filming a scene in Wicklow, he was called upon to administer an injection to her bruised posterior. But while Irish censors obsessed about protecting young people's morals from the temptations of sensuality, back in America, the industrious Father Laud was learning, through films, that sensuality sells. If it could sell films, cars and soap powder, the good father asked himself, why could it not also be used to sell chastity? As somebody not prone to idleness, Laud tested his concept by sitting down to type a succession of pamphlets aimed at teenagers. This ensured that the previously staid Catholic Truth Society pamphlets would never quite be the same again. Father Laud knew the tricks to attract young people's attention in the 1940s and 50s. In the heavily censored Ireland of those years, what boy or girl could resist peeking at his Catholic Truth Society pamphlets when he tantalised them with titles like Nobody Loves a Tease, What to Do on a Date, Fashionable Sin, or So We Abolished the Chaperone? The Irish editions of his pamphlets may have required some editing. In the Australian text of What to Do on a Date, Laud's wise pipe-smoking priest and two teenagers discussed the dangerous practice of park and neck in their father's borrowed car. This practice was less widespread and glamorous in rural Ireland, where the main means of transport was often the crossbar of a bicycle, and the boy, like any snooker player, or Hollywood husband, needed to keep one foot on the ground, although more for the sake of balance than decency. The advice contained in these pamphlets was not exactly progressive. In one pamphlet entitled What Not to Do on a Date, the Jesuit Father McLean outlined his F-E-A-R rule. If kisses are frequent, enduring and ardent, there can hardly be any just reason for them. This would seem comical if such works hadn't helped create the repressed moral environment where, as novelist Edna O'Brien has recalled, as a girl she viewed her body as a sort of tabernacle of sin. In a pamphlet entitled Questions Young Girls Ask, Father Thomas Finnegan declared that to love is to suffer. He devised an easy way for girls to keep lustful thoughts at bay. Domestically minded girls should shift their thoughts to deciding what colour schemes they would like in their homes after marriage, while sporty girls should fantasise that a rich uncle was buying them a car and focus their thoughts on the merits of the different models available. However, the seductively alluring style of the cover suggests that some designers involved would have been prized by Don Draper and his fellow venal advertising executives in the Mad Men television programme. It seems strange that while the conservative Irish Catholic Truth Society understood the attractiveness of such art to a young audience in the 1950s, in that same decade the Irish Arts Council appeared to have not yet grasped the power of commercial art, condemning the modernist posters for Aer Lingus as having little artistic merit. The Irish Catholic Truth Society preached chastity by commissioning teasingly striking artwork by Irish artists like George Monks, Sean Best and Alfred Monaghan, pamphlet covers that looked as tantalising as any pulp fiction. Sadly, the earnest authors of such pamphlets as I Have Left School, The Young Lady Says No, or the mysteriously entitled Sister Felicitas Wins a Bicycle, which conjures up images of a nun making a mad dash for freedom, are forgotten today. But what remains cherished by connoisseurs of commercial and pop art are the alluring cover images produced by artists who seemed to play with just how far they could push the limits of their design brief. These drawings prove that while the devil may be said to produce the best tunes, God, it could be argued, produces the best covers.
Mam and Daisy are in the shop looking at photos from their week in Spain. They're laughing, but stop when I put my head around the door. I'm trying not to let the bottles of Smirnoff and tonic clink together because Mam doesn't want Daisy to know that she hasn't got a drink in the house. I'm not sure why. They're sitting at the table beside the till. Most of the shop lights are off, so I can't see the wool skirts on the circular rail, nor the longer dresses to my left. I can see the stand with the iron-on yellow smiley faces and Mam dressed in her usual black polo neck under the spotlight from the window. And in the window, mannequins like people with their backs to us. There's a stew, Mam says. I'll be in a minute. As I leave, Daisy says, my God, that girl looks lovelier every time I see her. I make my way down the dark corridor to the kitchen and sitting room behind the shop. I like Daisy for this and because she used to let me babysit for her girls. And when I play the piano, she tells me I am a genius. Some part of me thinks that I might have some genius in me, but it's very well hidden. I put the bottles on the kitchen counter and take the lid off the stew. There's a hard white fat on top. I get a spoon and start to scrape it off. That will melt back in, Mom says, coming through the door. We used to put that dripping on our bread when I was a child. It's good for you. She pours out vodka, then tonic, rummages in the freezer for ice, and the tonic fizzes around the cubes when she drops them into the glasses. Ice and heels clicking, she goes back down the corridor already talking. She might as well have another one. Jim can run you home. Dad is probably in the gym trying to pretend that he's fit and young. I wish we could all sit in front of the telly in the den upstairs like we used to, eating one of Dad's curries and watching something funny. When I walk in on my mother and her friends or people from the shows, I feel like I'm part of some play she's writing in her head. Sometimes I'm the pain in the ass teenager. Other times a gifted dancer just like her. I'm never sure of my part, my lines. But now there seems to be some other play going on, and the props in this play are glasses of vodka and photographs from the holiday that I have not yet seen. I eat even though Mags and I are on a diet, but I'm failing at this and in school, and there will be hell to pay if I don't get to my school report before Dad sees it. I should do some homework, but instead I go into the sitting room to play records on the stereo. Mom is sitting on her green velvet sofa. Dad must be gone with Daisy. "Did you see the photographs?" she says, holding them up. I walk over. "No." "This is the place we were staying." Mom and Daisy are posing in front of a swimming pool. Mom is wearing a big sun hat, tilted, of course, the brim shading one side of her face. Annoyingly, that same style of hat suits my face as well. I've tried others, but this big brim thing is the only one that looks okay. And this is Stein's boat. He took us out most days. I take in the small yacht, white sails against the indigo sky, and the silhouette of a man. Something in me stills like a cat when another cat has entered their territory. This is a better photo of him. There he is. A middle-aged, blonde, grey-haired man with light blue eyes. She's waiting to see what I will say. I say nothing. He was lovely. He's lovely, isn't he? Her eyes are swimmy and unfocused, and I'm starting to realise that I am in the new play. No, I'm in the audience or the pub afterwards, and she's telling me what it was like to be centre stage again. What it was like to play opposite a new leading man with kind blue eyes. One part of me even understands. I touch the velvet of the sofa where my fella and I were kissing late on Saturday night when they were all asleep upstairs, and I'm thinking, this is my time to fall in love, not yours. I make a point of looking away from the photo and over at the orange lamp glowing softly like the evening sun in Spain. "He's Dutch," she says. "I have to do homework." But she's not looking at me as I make a flouncy exit stage right. She's looking at the photograph.
Harmonia Mundi. Oh, to be okay in the world's glory. In Paris, in La Dame Blanche record shop, pulling out the teak drawers of records. Okay with not being able to choose, because take one, take Ornette, away from all the other jazz from A to Z. Take one, Charpentier, from the drawer where also lives Couperin and Harmonia Mundi, which must mean the harmonies of the world. And I could cry at the appositeness of that. And you only have a slice of this everything. Staggered because being here means that. As I begin to understand on the metro, watching the shine on the lip of a small overalled man and all there is. Taking part in it like the creperie waiters leaning at the lamppost back of the Pantheon. As a woman walks by and leaves perfume and heels sound, and perhaps a sense that in this top with the shoulder straps today, she has something. Thinking I may never be known, and content on this road of my conversation with everything. And the taste in a sugared crepe, that was not the taste I wanted, but is the taste of here and so to be never forgotten. Nor the tambourine sound in back of the day, the waitress coming out to the path here on earth to shout, "Hey, oh, oh," at the truck going up the street in the wrong direction.
On this morning's programme we heard When Love Story Came to School by Fergal O'Doul. Getting Away With It was by Molly Fury. One Day with Marianne by Joe Carney. The Charity Hop a poem by Margaret Galvin. Judging Books by Their Covers by Dermot Bulger. Photograph of Stein by Lani O'Hanlon.